I think about 6 months later, I made the decision that I was going to move to London. I was going to train, and it was definitely something I wanted to do. But I didn't want to do theater. So even then, I had notions.
Welcome to the Social Fabric podcast. I'm your host, Andrea Splendori, and this week my guest is Emmett Kelly. Emmett is an actor, director, and screenwriter. His movies have been shown at festivals in Chicago, Belfast, and across Ireland. You can find more episodes on socialfabric.ie, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. The program is also broadcast every Monday on Dublin's Near FM 90.3. The music choice has been shortened for rights reason, but you can find the full collection on Social Fabric playlist on Spotify. Please subscribe, share, and review. It's the only way independent podcasts like this have a chance to survive. If you want to get in touch with the program, please email me at info@socialfabric.ie.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days, and we could talk a while. Just sit and talk a while.
Let's get started. So I'm not here with Emmett Kelly. I'm miles away from Emmett, but we're having a chat over Zoom. And I tell you what, we're going to start, Emmett. Let's start from the coronavirus, because that's why we're not sitting in the same room, which I would have liked to. How is it treating you? What's going on with you?
I'm fortunate. I'm good. You know, I don't have anyone near me or close to me that's vulnerable, which is very rare. Just means I've lost them before, kind of a thing. But my work, I can work from home, and I was only thinking about it last night. I was thinking about it this morning. Like, I really can't complain. Like, my biggest problem is not being able to see movies, go to the cinema and stuff like that. Obviously, face-to-face meetings. And yesterday I had to do two auditions, and one of them had to be done over Skype. So usually if you're doing a self-tape at home, you've got an actor who's just off camera. And, you know, you're doing things like that. But other than that, I really can't complain. It's unusual not meeting people every day, and when you meet people to just back off, kind of a thing. And then if you have to go into shops and stores, it's very surreal. But you know, I can't complain, and I'm healthy, relatively young, and I have no yeah. How about you?
I'm fine. Yeah, no, I'm just doing the same, keeping very, very away from everybody as much as I hate doing, but it's the obvious thing to do. Yeah, and everybody seems to be buying into it, which is great. How about your community there? How's that? Like, you know, is neighborhoods kind of looking after each other, or?
They are. I suppose it's not gotten rough yet, so the cases are still small, and there isn't as huge of a need for kind of a community support. But there's been loads of people, even not, you know, in Greystones, you have the Greystones open forum and a couple of things like that. In Stony Batter, there's a couple of pages like that, and you've seen people say, look, I'm going to be free for the next couple of weeks if anyone wants groceries dropped, dogs walked, or anything like that. So it's very unusual seeing all the shops on the street in Stony Batter kind of closed, bar groceries and chippers. And like, you know, I suppose those places are always going to stay open. And the local bars and stuff like that closed as well. And you see people walking around Stony Batter then, and they're just, you can tell, they're just walking around and they have no idea what they're doing. They're just walking down the street, just going, I'll just turn right up this street and see where we go. You know, they're just out for a ramble. There's no kind of end result. You're not, you know, walking to work or a meeting or even to meet people, you know. There was a bit of a backlash, I think, when the time when the pubs closed, and a lot of pubs didn't close at the time. When the government announced the pubs to close or advised them all to close, yeah. But I think for a while, people were just, I don't know, they were taking a chance or something, or they weren't. I suppose there's an element of younger people going, well, you know, it's not going to affect me too badly. And people maybe didn't have enough information or something like that. And then people got too much information with all of that fake news, and which was atrocious. People people, I'd be looking at my phone and someone would send me something and I'd just be replying back, stop sending me stuff, you know, just, this is ridiculous. Like people talking about the army and all this kind of stuff. And you're just going, who sent you that? Where's, show me one piece of information that links that to a relevant article, a government or a reliable source or a journalist. And nobody, you know, It's, I understand when people get panicked in a situation when there's a pandemic and there's a crisis, but like, I'm talking about smart people sending me these videos. And, you know, usually it would have been someone's mother or, you know, someone who wouldn't be social media savvy and they'd text you on something or they'd send you on one of these, you know, pray for this person, say amen, pass on the link on Messenger. And you just like hand, you know, just do the thumbs up back to them. But you'd be like, you can flip off. You think I'm, you know, but these people were sending me this stuff and they have like, master's degrees, PhDs, or they've these businesses, or they're really successful in their field, and you're just kind of going, I can't believe you got suckered into all that, you know.
But I suppose it's the lack of human touch, human contact at the moment. You know that we're not like, if you say that while you're sitting having a coffee with your mates, they'll tell you off straight away. But now you just sit in your room and you just. And what do you do to keep sane and fit and healthy?
we've all turned into social media warriors, haven't we?
No,
turned into trolls.
And what do you do then to keep fit and healthy and sane? I mean, obviously your routine is disrupted. And how are you structuring the day in a way to keep you sane?
Yeah, I got sick enough at the end of last year and the start of the new year, so I had to sort of claw back what I was doing, and I was essentially self-isolating anyway. So I had to change around the whole schedule, and I realized very early on that a routine is just essential, and a good diet is essential, and physical activity is, I mean, that'll look after you mentally. Do you know what I mean? Blow off the cobwebs by going for a walk. So I get up early in the morning. I've scheduled a timetable for myself, and I'll go for two walks in Phoenix Park. I live right next to it, so it's pretty handy. And then I'll eat at the same time every single day. As boring as it sounds, but routine. And then at nighttime, I'll sit down and I'll watch a movie and eat a copious amount of ice cream. But like, it's just so, you know, it's my new thing, chocolate cake and ice cream, and I mix it together. So I have more of a chance of getting diabetes than COVID-19. And, you know, it's like, yeah, that's the problem with me, like, you know. But routine. And I'm talking to friends, and my friends are like going, you know, they're saying, one person was like, I didn't get out of bed until 2 o'clock. And I'm like, that is a terrible idea. Do it for a few days or a week. Do you know, if you haven't had a break in months or years, but don't get into the habit of going to bed late and getting up late. It's bad. It's bad enough when in a normal situation, actors and creatives are very much like that. You know, they as creative and as productive as they can be, they can be pretty bad for structure. And it's bad enough in normal scenarios, but when there's you're asked to social isolate and there's semi lockdowns, in particular, someone sleeping in until the afternoon is a dreadful idea. Your mental health will drop off a cliff like very quickly. So I think everyone should just do a routine. And if you're fortunate enough that you can't work right now, when have you ever been given an opportunity to learn or do something? You know, like badly. I've started learning how to paint, and honest to God, I can't wait until it finishes and I can stop doing it, because, you know, I'm actually insulting artists or people who have genuine talent. Do you know what I mean? I heard Francis Bacon said he dropped out of college or he didn't, or something like that. He didn't want to, he thought that they were ruining his natural creativity. And I am proof that not everyone has natural creativity when it comes to the creative pursuits, because like, it's like they look like stick men, but bad stick men. You know what I mean? But it's good, because it's something I promised myself I'd always do. And I have an easel. It used to be my mother's. And I said, why not? You know, it's therapeutic, at least, if anything else, you know.
Absolutely. Okay, let's break it up with your first song then, Emmett. What have you got for me? What's your first tune?
And why first tune. Okay, so firstly, music is not great with me. I'm not a musical person. I find it as a trigger. I'm not the kind of person. I will walk down the street and I'll listen to a score of a film, or even a bit of classical music or do something like that. But as regards songs itself, I find it a trigger and it's not great with me. But first song is Damien Rice, Delicate.
Okay. So, and why do you pick that one?
There's a live version that he did in Union Chapel and himself and Lisa Hannigan. And Damien Rice is someone that, like, I think it's like a play. Some people, they'll perform and it's relatively the same every single time. And Damien Rice just changes it up all the time. But when he's performing something live, it is incredibly raw. And you're listening to this song, it's on YouTube, it's on Spotify, and you just, the notes he hits and the range, but the actual emotion and power behind it, you can't but be taken by it. And Lisa Hannigan as well. And she's giving it all as well. But I mean, it's just a really moving and powerful piece.
We might kiss when we are alone, when nobody's watching. We might take it home. We might make out.
Just tell me a little bit about you in terms of, you don't have a Dublin accent, am I right? Tell me about growing up and who are you? You come from and all that.
You got a couple of hours.
Get down to 5 minutes.
Yeah. 10 seconds, Emmett. Put it into a log line like a film, you know. And if people are interested, they can look at that part of the podcast or skip on. They'll skip on, like, no problem at all. I'm a twin. I don't think you know that, do you?
I do, actually, yeah. You mentioned to me, and Colm is your twin brother, right?
Yeah, twin brother. And we're from County Waterford. We come from a place that is, like, so rural that there's not even a village. Do you know what I mean? There's just like a bloody church. And then a couple hundred meters down the road, there's a hall. And then about a kilometer away, there's a petrol station kind of a thing. So it's very, very rural. So I'd say people at home looking at my vocation or what I ended up doing are just thinking there's something wrong with him, you know, probably. But I've 7 siblings and played a lot of sports growing up, and I think sports really, really helped as regards the discipline. So I work really hard at what I do, but you know that I think you pick it up with good habits. You know, when you see, like, if I had kids in the morning, I'd just send them down to the GA club just as early as possible, because it puts such a drive and a discipline, and you learn how to work hard, you learn how to teamwork and stuff like that. And when I was in secondary school, college, it was always the same. Like, you could see the people who played sports were a little bit more driven and a bit hardworking. Now, that's a sprint, life is a marathon, and you know, people change and adapt and stuff like that. But I think when you're from rural Ireland, like, you have to do these things, and sports really helped a lot of me and my friends anyway. It's a very important part of your life. And then you use what you learn from sports then in whatever vocation or other hobbies or things that you do down the line, you know? That's where I'm from. And
That's interesting. So 7 siblings in this, affecting your house, and then nothing near you. So growing up, what was it like then? I mean, was it just like this apart from the GAA and all the sports here? Because I'm just trying to, I'm trying to figure out, and that'll be the question coming up after in terms of getting into movies and acting and all that, where that all that come from. But I mean, trying to picture Emmett and his six brothers and sisters.
We were so, myself and my twin, my mother was 39 or 40 when she had us, which wouldn't be old now. You know, a lot of people are having kids older, but back then it was pretty old. And I think my next brother up is 3.5 years older than me, and they thought they were done. Do you know what I mean? And then they found out they were having twins, and you know, and everyone else. I've brothers all a brother who's up to, I think he might be 40. He'll kill me if I get the age wrong. Say he's mid to late 40s. Okay, very late 40s. So they were all a lot older. But like in the countryside, you know, it was pretty easy. So they threw us into this room, and they just closed off the door frame, you know, at about 2.5-3 feet high. And it was, I'm serious. This was like a zoo, you know, and people would come to the doorway, and myself and Colm, being babies, would be playing. And then we'd come to the doorway where the gate was, and it was like a bloody zoo. And they'd pick us up and then put us back down, and we'd go back playing again. And you know, it was bloody fantastic because there was two of us, so we'd have our own little language. We'd be playing with ourselves. We'd have build our own imagination, our own forts and stuff like that. And I still remember like vivid memories of being in this room. But like, it's weird because I was a baby. Like, well, a baby, I'd say up to about 3, 3.5 or something, or 4, probably even a bit older, you know. And the siblings then, because they're much older than you, but kind of come semi-parents as well, especially the older ones. So I had two sisters, and one of them definitely mothered us to within an inch of her lives. I was glad she had kids in the end, because she'd stop mothering us. You know, just like, go away, will you? And and it was always good. And, you know, if you were getting a spin up to training or a match or something, someone would pick you up and drive you there or something like that. So it was good, because a lot of people, if they only have the two parents, it's like, mom, dad, you know, can I do this? And if they're saying, well, I'm not around, good luck. Whereas I think they were always looking for us to do stuff to get us out of the house and get us occupied. But it was good. It was great. But everyone was so busy then, that they were so older, that it's not like there were seven of us in the backyard trying to play. There was three of us for a while. And then Gary, my older brother, you know, 3 years older, I think once you hit 11, 12, you're not going to be hanging out with your 7, 8-year-old kid brother, kind of a thing. But the age brackets are so large then that my oldest brother had a child. So my nephew is only 5 years younger than me. One of my nephews. I've 20 nephews, 20 plus now at this stage. Oh, brilliant. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Don't even bother learn their name until they're 6 months old. It doesn't count, you know. So my nephew is 5 years younger than me. So when I was, you know, about 11, 12, we'd look after him because he was our nephew, and we felt, oh, you know, I'm his uncle or whatever. So we were teaching him how to play hurling and football and soccer. And that was the good thing about being in the countryside. My father was a woodworker. He had a kitchen and furniture business, and the factory was right next to the house. So we would forever get goalposts. Now, we'd make them ourselves after a while, once we'd annoyed dad enough, and anyone who was working there, which was always family members or an uncle or something like that, we'd annoy them so much because we'd keep breaking the goals that they just let us make them ourselves, which is fine, because you could just make it, break it in 2 weeks, and then go away and make another one, because there was a huge supply of timber. And that was the coolest thing about being in the countryside, because like, that's all you did really, is just play sports and stuff like that. But that's how you kept busy, I guess, you know.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, well, let's give us a second tune, please.
Second tune, Nick Cave, Red Right Hand, from, it's definitely used in Peaky Blinders anyway, but it's been around for a good few years. And the reason is because it's so such a visual song. You don't even have to listen to the words. That kind of song that you'd be walking down the streets, and like I think Cillian Murphy was shocked when they realized that the score and the soundtrack of Peaky Blinders was going to be so contemporary, as opposed to, you know, and thank God they did that, because there's really good shows that are ruined by just violin scores, and just this, you know, it takes the punch away. And Nick Cave, especially in Red Right Hand, is it just hits you. Do you know what I mean? Really, really just hits you. And it's one of those songs that you could be doing something and it just comes on and you'll just stop and you'll truly just listen to it. Whereas 99% of the time I'd be listening to music and, you know, I'm lost to it. You know, I've got friends who are musicians and I, honest to God, the best acting I've ever done is talking to them, listening to their songs, you know. Just jeez, that's brilliant. Jesus, Mike, that's you know, gets me there, you know. I have no friend whose Mike is a musician, but, you know, I mean, I just can't appreciate it. Other people can appreciate it, you know.
Absolutely.
But it's a trigger for me. They left me on my own in a room listening to that music. I just come out like as if I listened to Radiohead for 2 years, and I'd just be like, I'd be like, the world has no meaning. Are those my hands? There's no point, you know. There's no point. I wish I loved music, but
that's,
I don't.
Fair enough.
You know,
that's,
give me a painting or a picture. I'd rather look at a book of photos. Do you know what I mean? Because at least I could make up what's happening. You know, picture a moment captured, and then you can kind of figure out what was happening before, what was happening after, or, you know. But songs are not the same. But that changes, you know.
Take a little walk to the edge of town and go across the track, where the viaduct looms like a bird of doom as it shifts and cracks, where secrets lie in the border fires and the humming wires. Yeah, man, you know you're never coming back. Across the square, across the bridge, past the mills, past the stack.
But that's interesting, because that's my next question there was very much about why acting, and in a way you kind of started answering it by saying, you know, like, okay, so a piece of music that is fully formed, it's giving you the full story. You don't have to do anything about it, you just have to sit and listen. Well, your as you just mentioned, your picture or writing or acting, you need to interpret it. You need to come up with something yourself. And
yeah.
So why acting? How did you get into it? And why?
It's something I always wanted to do. And in rural Ireland, and still to this day, because, you know, it's not like, I know people are saying it's a different world and all that. And it is, yeah. But some places, no. Like some places in the country are still relatively the same. There was no drama. There was no acting. There was no drama lessons. There was no anything like that growing up. And I always wanted it. I'd watch movies and I'd come out of it and my friends and my brother and all of us, and I'd be like, did you notice the camera just slowly going in on this scene? And then when it went to the other actor, it was just slowly going out. And I'd just be enthralled by how they made the films, the actors, the performances. And I'd watch bad movies as well, just so I'd, you know, you might learn something or whatever. And it never occurred to me that I could do that until a friend of mine asked me, would I be an actor in one of her plays down in East Cork. And I was 21 or something like that. And I was like, no. And then, but she wouldn't take no for an answer because she's stubborn like myself. So she, I'd always call her like a sister of mine because she's my, my best friend's sister. So she got me involved, and I remember doing the first rehearsal, just going, huh, this is really interesting, that we'd do a take, or a rehearsal, and we'd do a run of it, and then we'd do something completely different the next time. She'd tell me something, and the first time I knew that I had to look for something, an objective or the basis of a technique is what she was kind of teaching me. And I was just like, yeah, that's it. This is way too interesting, you know. If I could do this, or if I could train to do this. And I think about 6 months later, I made the decision that I was going to move to London. I was going to train, and it was definitely something I wanted to do. But I didn't want to do theater. So even then, I had notions. And I was just like, I liked theater, but film was just the end all, you know, just the idea of what you can do on film, you know, like the shame of theater is beautiful and brilliant when it's done right. But it's only the audience that sees it, you know? And if you're unfortunate enough that nobody comes to see the show, or it coincides with bloody World Cup or something, or like COVID now, it's after taking a lot of plays down. I know a lot of them will come back up again. But you're working months, and you're giving it 100% every single time you step into a rehearsal room or when you're on stage, and the work that goes into it, even getting yourself physically and mentally right, even on the day, but even before the play and stuff like that. And then it's fine if you're in the Abbey or you're in the Gate or the Gaiety or something like that. But a lot of actors, before they hit that, you know, they have to go to the New Theatre, the Smock Alley, the Boys' School, Teachers Club, all these little venues around town. And you might do a whole play and 200 people might see it. And you're just kind of going, it's a lot of work for very little payback, you know, creatively.
That's an interesting one, because I always thought as an actor, and I understand it's almost like the difference between the guys that runs the 100 meters and he works all year to do the 100 meters and he gets it done, and the guy goes and plays football in front of 600,000 million people and he's the most famous man in the world. You know, if I ask you athletics don't get as much and they work harder than a footballer would. But at the same what about that immediate feedback that you get in a theater? Like, okay, there might be 200 people, but you're standing there, you do your bit, and you get the round of applause and you get the standing ovation. Is that not something that you don't get from a cinema?
I think it's the exact same. You get the exact same. It's a great feeling having a standing ovation, and it's an amazing feeling when someone reaches out to you after the play or contacts you and the content of what you did. Like I wrote plays, I directed plays, and I acted in plays for a couple of years. Yeah, and it was great. It was really, really great. But getting numbers to see it is the problem. And you can't get paid because not enough people came to see the play. And then you're going to lose money putting on a play as well. And that's fine. But it's insane to do that over and over and over again. You know, and if you make a film, say you put 3,000 euros into a play, at least if you put 3,000 euros into a film, the audience is endless, and you can, you know, one good film festival, there'll be more people see your work than on the theater, on the stage. Now it's a different medium and stuff like that. And it's, you know, apples and oranges or whatever the saying is. But when I was training, that the best actors that I had followed came from theater. And I thought, okay, I want to be as trained and as well-trained as I possibly could be. And I did love the theater, but films was always the thing. It was like, you know, Sundays being at home and you're sitting with your mother, you're watching a Western since I was a child, movies had always been hugely important. I look back at watching movies with my mother and I realize how important it was now. And even the TV show is Bonanza. Do you know that one? And just watching all these programs. And now you look back at it going, oh, that was great. You know, that's where the film love was formed. But really, it was just me telling her to stop talking and asking questions every 3 minutes when we're watching a film. You're like, you're watching the same film as me. How do you not know who this character? You know what I mean? It's just like, she was the worst person in the world to watch a movie with. But she did, to be fair, She loved all the old Westerns and she loved all the old movies. And if there was a movie on a particular night, she'd let me know and I'd sit down and I'd watch it with her. So, and it really did actually give, you know, because maybe some people sat down and they just watched bad movies and they were like, movies just, you know, but I was fortunate that I saw really, really amazing movies early on. And then I was like seeing what you can do with sound, with picture, with performance, with writing. And so being, you know, the state, being on stage and being a theater and all that is fantastic, but it's not, it's film is what I always wanted. So I used it as a way to get into it and training, you know.
Brilliant. All right. What's your next song, please?
Next song, Gregory Alan Ishkov. I'm not sure of the surname, and the song is called Liars. He's a singer-songwriter. I think he's originally from Canada. And I had tried to improve my music tastes by just finding someone random every single week or every 2 weeks and listening to their songs and seeing if I can kind of get into it. And I found this guy and he was amazing. But once again, this song is just raw, you know, and it starts kind of nearly acoustic and then, you know, the rest of the band and the, I don't know what you call it, the other instruments and all that come in. But it's just powerful. You can be walking down the street and straight away, there's a movie in your head or there's a scenario or you're daydreaming. You become Walter Mitty walking down the street and you're forgetting, you know, you're after walking past where you're supposed to be going or something. You get really just caught up in the music. And as rare as it is for that to happen to me, I'm sure it happens to loads of other people a million times. But that was one of the songs. And I think some songs are like movies. It's like a three-act structure, start, middle, and an end, and it really hits it at three-quarters point. They either hit their objective or not. And, you know, there's that sort of building theme in the song, and I like that. But this song is very, very, very impactful.
You take the big one, I'll take his brother. Let's get this over with, 'cause I'm late for work. Do you run?
Okay, you mentioned your movies, and you're kind enough to let me use one of your movies, The Current, at the live show we did last month, and it was great. And you've had a couple other movies, including one called Space Between Us, that was shown at the Southside Irish Parade Film Festival. And there are a couple of more, but just tell me about the process of, like, you're obviously writing them, acting in most of them, on some of them, or you, what's your writing process? And what, like, obviously you're tuned in to what's going on. Even earlier on when you were telling me about your growing up and, yeah, and the woodwork beside, in my head I was like, yeah, there's a movie there, I'm sure you can put together a short movie of the kids building their their goalpost and knocking them down. And, you know, what's your writing process, and how did you come about to do the likes of The Current, which was really, really nice movie, short movie? Tell us about
a bit. Firstly, I'm going to steal your idea and tell everyone that I came up with it myself.
Do, please.
Yeah. it's some scripts, without sounding completely, you know, like a Muppet. Some scripts really, really, they come to you, they hit you, you know. There's a story forms in your head.
Yep.
And you just know you've got a great one. And then all of the other scripts that you're writing then aren't up to that spec. And you essentially use it down the line for a scene, a character or something like that, but it's more practice, you know. But every so often you think of something and you're like, yeah, that's, I can feel it in my gut. That's something that I'm going to do. And that's, I wouldn't say that stuff that I do, I'm aware of what's happening in the world and stuff that's going on. Like, once or twice I've been asked to do something that is relevant, or I'd be commissioned to write something or do something like that. But it tends to be family or personal dramas, kind of real to life or social problems that I like. I tend to start writing something and I wouldn't, it could take a year. It's not like I'm working at it for a year, but I'd put it away for a couple of months and then go back to it and put it away and come back to it. And once I know it in my head, then I'll throw away what I've kind of written and then I'll write down a couple of more drafts and then it's done. And the only time I'll change it then is in rehearsal or something like that. But the idea just kind of forms into your head, and you know, after a couple of months, you kind of get it. I wouldn't be mad for stealing ideas from life. I've done that once or twice, and it's just awkward if family, you know, you've very awkward conversations with the people who watch it and just go, is that me? Which person am I? And, you know, it's important. I think most films, especially people starting out in film, they'll do films about themselves for their first one or two. They'd very rarely knock it out of the park the first time. It usually takes a couple of bad films and stuff like that. The only major film that I really did write about myself was like Lost Memories. But that was such a colossal change in my life in losing my mother that I thought it was just something that I just really needed to do. But from here on in, I'm really just concentrating on using elements of your life, but fictional characters and fictional circumstances. I've been writing this script for the guts of a year about Alzheimer's. A son who's caring for his dad who has Alzheimer's, and he's in the latter stages where he's just about to go into care and can't be really kept at home anymore. And the son is he's trying to get that one last real moment with his father. And he's kind of living in his father's reality, you know, playing along to his father thinks it's his brother, you know, and he's just fighting really, really hard to stay in his life and still have his dad. And while I've known people who've had Alzheimer's and dementia, but it's a completely fictional piece, but I can definitely draw on the relationship between the father and son with my own relationship with my dad and stuff like that. So that's where the writing is kind of going now, as it is completely fictional, but using bits of your own life and finding out how to relate to something. I sent that script to a good couple of colleagues of mine, and I tend to be good at dialogue. I tend to be awful at writing the descriptions of the scene. So I could write for a quarter of a page of a description because, you know, I've been doing it for so long now that everyone gives me different tips, notes, you know, and people would be saying, oh, no. So your description should be this. And other people would be saying other stuff. So now I just write it like a short story, and I just give it to, like, I refuse now, even when I'm coming to the final draft, to just change it. Cause as I say, look, interior, exterior, is it inside? Is it outside? The crew know that then. Okay. So when we're prepping, you know, that's pretty much it. After that, I'll write down what it has to be. I'm not going to tell the camera, the DOP, I'm not going to say push in at this point. You know, that's a discussion in pre-production. I'll just write down essentially like a short story about what's happening between the two main the main characters, and then what the dialogue makes 100% sense then, you know. So my format is very, while it's still filmmaking format and the same technique, I don't adhere to the same rules as regards description, because I know directors who just spend so much time getting that down to two lines or three lines, and they just write the dumbest things, you know. They write down like someone felt like a razor on the inside of their chest or something. And I'd be like, just why don't you just write it down in three lines? Just like write down what's happening in the relationship between the father, the son, what someone has just done and what he is, you know what I mean? Just write it down in a couple of lines. Don't be trying to look overly smart by putting it into a log line. Yeah. You know, now granted, when you're going for funding and stuff like that, they might ask for 10 pages and you end up giving them 14 pages, and then they'll have to, you know, you'll have to work it down for specific things like that if you're going for funding. But if you're lucky enough that you get funded by production companies and private funding, and that's not a privilege thing, that's like people have seen your work and they're supporting you and they want you know, they want to be part of what you're doing going forward because it works very good for them as well. You don't have to change the writing technique a huge amount then. On the other side, people have said in the past, they've given notes to your script. And if you're going to receive funding, sometimes you have to take that, but then sometimes then you can be a little bit bullish as well. So the one film before, someone asked us to change around something completely in the script, and we were like, no. And it was just like, thanks. And they were like, you're not going to change it. We're like, no, thank you for the offer. But no, we'll just go along. We'll make it ourselves. And they just went along. They was just like, yeah, okay, fine. Just go away. Sometimes people, if they're making a film with you or putting money in, they want to put their mark in it. You know, they want to give an idea about the script, but like, that's not your job. You know what I mean? If you're going to ruin something, you might look at it and think, okay, it's not going to change the story completely. But from a filmmaker's point of view, an actor's point of view, or anyone else, the pacing is now suddenly just gone in the film. Or there's just this visual moment that they didn't get in the script that the audience will get watching, because the score is going to be there, the performance is going to be there, or there's going to be subtle camera movements or something like that. And you have to watch it. So sometimes, you know, when someone's reading a script or your work or something like that, you have to be fairly precious about it. Now, when you're writing, if I was writing a script and I wanted notes from you, okay, you knew something about podcasts or Italy or anything like that you would know more about specifically than me, I'm not precious at all. Because if you tell me something doesn't work, I'll scribble that out, because I'll be like, oh, he's right, actually, you know. So you can't be precious about the work, but once you know something works and it's right, and especially if the script is finished, yeah, you got to really stand up for it then, you know.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. What's your song number 4, please?
Okay. Song number 4 is Billie Eilish, Bad Guy. So that song has been everywhere. And I think she's just amazing. She was 16 or 17 when she did it, or when she made that song. She works with her brother. She's not bloody half naked on stage. You know, if anything, she's just herself, wears what she wants, says what she wants. She's so polite in interviews, you know, and she's just so talented, so raw. I can see why she was hired to do the new James Bond film.
Yeah.
Cause it's like she's 70 or 80. Do you know what I mean? She's got an old soul in her, you know? But the song itself is really catchy. It's amazing. I suppose it's younger people and teens loved it so much, and they probably see me, you, or any of us listening to it, and they're like, oh God almighty, this is so embarrassing, you know what I mean?
Criminal bruises on both my knees for you. that bad type. Make your mama sad type. Make your girlfriend mad type. Might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy.
So tell me something. Speaking of acting, like what you just mentioned there about writing and the script and how you need to be precious about it. And obviously, you're, I don't know whether perfectionist is the right word, but you obviously love what you do and you love your vocation. You mentioned vocation a few times as opposed to your job, which is in itself gives us an idea of why you're doing and why, you know, because you're not, of course, you need to survive, you need to make some money, you need to pay your rent or your mortgage or whatever it is, but you're doing because you love doing it. And, you know, you mentioned Bonanza. I'm sure if I ask you to describe the best dance scene in Bonanza, you probably remember them. You know, you're just, you're tuned into what you do. So what's it like then as an actor? Because you're both a writer and an actor. What's it like as an actor to get a script? You get a job, you get paid, that's your script, and you go, oh, man, I wish I could change it. Or, how does that work?
So, like, getting a job from someone else. So, like,
yeah, you work on somebody else's script, or you know, you get a part. You go, MS, you're gonna be part of this movie. That's your scene, or your scenes, or whatever. You're this man.
Do you know what the first reaction is nowadays when I get cast in something? So, like, there's like all actors, you spend like yesterday I auditioned, twice yesterday and once the week before and the week before, and I think people are going to be auditioning more as this thing goes on at home. And when I get cast, the first thing I feel like is I get to put the feet up. I don't have to worry about pre-production, post-production. I don't have to worry about time. I don't have to be worried about anything else. And it's like being a guest on someone's, you know, and it's just perfect. Because then you can 100% focus on your character. You can simmer, you know, it, mentally, even when the cameras are being turned around or you're moving on to another scene. You can kind of hold that character a little bit. You're still talking away and stuff like that. And you get to have real fun. You get to have the actor who's opposite you. And 1,000% of your concentration is now on that person. And most of the most important thing for acting is reacting. It's listening, you know? So right now you're on the screen right now. And if I was doing a scene, you're the most important person in the scene to me. And if you act the same way and then it's live and it's a real conversation, it's a great piece. And when you're acting in someone else's film, you get to just 100% just dive into that. And it's fantastic. You can do it in your own films as well, but there is that at the back of your head after when cut is shouted and then you have to, you know, you're looking at the monitor and then someone is saying to you, look, we're pushed for time. And you have to make decisions then if you're gonna lose a shot or a sequence or something like that. And it's fantastic. I'm not one who at the end of the day goes, oh, I wish I did that. You know, I'm very simple when it comes to something like that. I'm like, it's if I was present, real, honest in the moment, and if I did all the preparation and the work and I looked after myself physically and mentally and I was just there on the day, listened to the director, collaborated with the other actors, I'm fine. That's grand. That's it. We achieved what we had to do at that given moment. And I'm not going to kick myself if it didn't work or if you're watching it 6 months later going, oh, do you know what? I could have approached the character this way. That's bull. Sorry.
You can say bullshit. It's all right.
It's bullshit. It's utter bullshit because you're evolving as a person. You're not who you were 6 months ago. You are who you are now. If you had that script now, your performance is obviously going to be different.
Okay.
6 months time, it's going to be different. So why would you kick yourself over being honest 6 months ago and giving the best performance possible when you that's the information that you had? You know, it's nonsense. And I don't understand why actors do it. I can understand watching films. I don't watch myself on screen anymore because I've seen it, you know, stuff that I've worked on, that I've produced, directed, written or anything like that. I've seen it a thousand times. So when we did the screening at The Current, I had headphones in because, you know, there was, and I'd look up every so often and I was more interested. I was looking at the audience anyway. I wanted to see what their reaction was, whether they'd like it or hate it or, you know, whether I could show my face in Greystones ever again. but when it's not your film and you're just an actor in it. I might watch it once or twice, but like, I know actors who won't watch it from a vanity point of view, because you know you're now on big screen being projected to an audience. And like, what did you think was going to happen? You're not going to have pores, you know, or wrinkles, or a 4K camera is not going to show up broken capillaries on your cheek or something, because you know you don't look like that. You know, even when you're in the cinema and you're looking at yourself on screen, you don't actually look like that. The camera is showing way more information than is actually there. The person who's sat next to you in the chair is not going to be able to see the same detail as you see on the screen. So, you know, you can kind of forget about the vanity stuff and all that, you know. But yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. I was just curious about that because obviously it's two sides of the one coin that, you know, but you by doing both, I was just curious. Okay, tell me about the next song then, Emmett, please.
Oasis, The Importance of Being Idle, which now is more important than anyone has ever, like, you know, people are going to be bored senseless over the next couple of months. So I think it's a perfect song. And Reese Ifans, or what, do you know the actor's name that's in it?
I don't know.
He's the music video. See, this is why I'm awful at music. If anyone who listens to this podcast who's like devout music fans have probably turned it off anywhere about 5 minutes in. Because like, they'd be like, this guy should be arrested for his crimes against music and singer-songwriters.
Cause the man
I was going, as I said, we have met once, twice, just briefly, don't really know each other, but I did a little bit of research on online, because that's the way at the moment to do research, and then there's so much information there. But there was, you put up a post, say it was Facebook, I can't remember exactly, but it was really, what really interested me, it was about you owning a wooden toy business for a short while, right?
But
I tell you what really interested me about all that, there was a great story about friendship, of you and your mates and people that saw you through the harsh hard times, whatever.
Yeah.
What is friendship to you, and how you nurture that? Because it's harder and harder at the moment. I have a great group of friends. We do the best we can to keep in touch all the time. Even at the moment, we're not seeing each other. We do the occasional virtual pub on Zoom, and they have the occasional coffee on Zoom, and it's great. Catch up, have a chat. Tell me a bit about that story, more so than the story. Like the whole friendship thing. It was a lovely thing there. So you still credit your friends in your films, which I thought was fabulous.
Yeah. No, I said my friend Connor Coughlin has more credits than some actors, you know, as associate producer. He has never done a single thing on set, you know what I mean? But like, if he ever wanted to impress someone, he could open up IMDb and they'd see straight away he's got all these credits. But you wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them, you know? When you do, like, it's great that you're having Zoom appointments with your friends and having a cup of coffee over it and saying hello to them. True friendship does not need maintenance, you know? And it's great. I'm not saying that you're doing the maintenance, because you guys are just like going, let's catch up. But you don't have to do it every day, every week. You might not talk to someone for 3 months, 6 months, and it's like those things you just, you know, you just click back in. And I love that about true friendships. And they're the ones that last decades. And when you need someone, they're there. And when my mother was sick, one of them was working for Kerry Group at the time, and he just didn't have time to like, he was being sent to America, he's been sent to the UK and stuff like that. And but anytime he was there, Jesus, you know, it was fantastic, and he really got me through it. And that's what he said about the wooden toy business. I set up the wooden tie business after my mother passed away because A, I needed money because I spent all of my money. I took months off work and I went down there. And B, I just wanted to do something that was ethical, kind of a thing. But my best friend gave me 2,000 euros, and I gave him the money back. But like, not only that, then he used to be there painting and sanding the timber in a spare bedroom in my house in Dublin, and really helped me through nearly like a grieving process by setting up this. Because yes, it was about a wage, but it was more keeping the mind busy and stuff like that. And he was absolutely fantastic. And he and Michal, there was three of us, our best friends since we were kids, and just absolutely fantastic in helping me out. And when we used to do like a festival or these markets, you know, they do these one-off markets and places and all that, and you'd have a stand and the lads would be behind the counter and I could go off for a cup of coffee or a sandwich, and they were just committed. And you know, you do that with your best friends, you know, no matter what they do. It's like that thing, if they ring you at 3 o'clock in the morning and they say, can you grab a shovel and a black bag, and you're like, yeah, fine, where'll I meet you? You have blind loyalty to these people, like blind loyalty. And yeah, but I mean, it's like, it's the amalgamation of thousands and thousands and thousands of micro moments that there's no one given huge, it's not like a movie, it's not one big moment, you know. It's just the trust, the love, the friendship. It's there and it'll always be there for the rest of your life. And when you need these people, they're there for you. And even if it's in a roundabout way, you know, I'm fortunate with my best friends, we can sit down and we can talk our emotions and just go, look, this sucks, you know, and I'm angry about this or I'm angry about that. And we'll talk about it together, and we'll realize what's important, what's not important, and stuff like that about what's happening in each of our lives. But other than that, then, you know, friends are great for helping like that, like the grieving process. Only after I grieved my mother did I realize that it was those evenings spent just talking shit with your friends, making those wooden toys, that kind of got you through it and made you think of, you know, your childhood, missing your mom, and you know, all these bloody memories that come flooding back, and issues that you had, family drama, you know, people not talking, people arguing, and the wreckage that kind of comes with a parent getting sick, and that remains after when someone dies anyway, and you have to get through a lot of that. And you know, I realized that all of that was essentially my best friend that got me through it. And more times than not, we didn't even directly talk about it. It was just actions. And that's why they get credits in the films. I'll start charging them. They're doing well now. They're doing really, both of them are doing really well. So I'm gonna start charging them €1,000 a credit. You know what I mean? Because I know that they like the idea. It's like, well, you know, I've made a couple of movies, you know, talking to people. So they can pay the piper now at this stage, you know.
Brilliant. Give us your second last song before I'll ask you the last question, please.
Second last song. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Oh yeah, sorry. See Ya, Space Between.
Yeah.
See Ya is... Do you listen to her, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. I know See Ya through my daughter. Through my daughter. Yeah.
She's your daughter. You see, See Ya's more... I think she's in her 40s, you know, and she had a previous career before, and she was an alcoholic, and then she came back from that and she made this new career. And I only realized, I, like everyone, listened to Elastic Heart and Chandelier, and obviously the reason, you know, the young girl that does the dancing, like, it's bloody amazing. It's like this, these films within the songs, just watching it and the movement, and Shia LaBeouf in Chandelier, just amazing, just really, really amazing. And I saw an interview with her and she didn't look to the camera, you know, or she when she performs live, she turns around, and it's just really interesting. And I was like, why is she doing that? Because she's not doing it in a bloody Lady Gaga kind of wearing meat as a bloody dress kind of nonsense. You know, she was doing it. There's something else there, you know, and I don't know, was this, I don't think it was just to look different, you know. I think there's a further sort of reason, a psychological reason, motivation why she does that. And I just think it's very interesting. And the more you listen to her music, then you realize she's more than singing. Like, she is just revealing so much about herself through that work. And she just breaks your heart the way she hits those notes. You can't but love someone like that and feel affected by their music, even if you're not into their genre of music.
An hour ending sentence in my head, we lay hollow in the emptiness. I'm too tired to push you from the bed. No more fighting, no more fighting.
Okay, we're just coming towards the end. You mentioned revealing a couple of times there in that last section. It fascinates me with most of the people I'm talking to, because most of the people I'm talking to, I get to know them through social media. I don't do a huge amount of social media, but that's where, if I was trying to do this podcast 10 years ago, it would take me 4 days to learn about somebody. Now I can do,
yeah.
I just go online and figure out who I'm talking to. And in particular with you, you put a lot of personal stuff online.
I'm stupid. Yeah. What can I say?
No. But it, look, there's nothing wrong with it. Absolutely nothing wrong with it. But it's why? For example, like, you know, you had a post yesterday, you know, probably, you know, talking about a lot about what you've gone through and a lot about, you know, obviously with your parents as part of the grieving process. I can understand that. What does it do for you, putting up, forgetting about all the, you know, we all get into a bit of a scrap about Trump or whoever it may be, you know, that's fine. I can get that. But when it becomes really personal, I'm just curious about that bit.
I on Twitter, I reveal, and on Facebook and Instagram, I use mostly just for work and letting people know what I'm doing and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I reveal enough about my parents, about their loss, grieving, and drink, alcoholism. I won't reveal much else other than that. Like, things that were important, the big, huge building blocks. Because, like, it's like a movie. It's like, I've done a movie before and someone has come up to you afterwards, or someone has emailed you a couple of weeks later and they've been affected by it, and they've used what you've gone through to, and they've just, you know, they've made peace with someone that they'd been arguing with in their life for years, or they've overcome, you know, they just let something go. And I think it's great for that. I think sometimes, especially when it comes to grieving, it's better out than in. More times than not, people don't talk about it enough. And yesterday I put up a tweet, or the day before, about being 100 days sober. I had a lot of people who DM'd me asking me different questions, and they were going through the same process, or they realize that they have a problem and they're leaning into it, and they realize they're either going to go the road of continuing where they're going and sort of self-hurting and numbing themselves and you know, not dealing with any issues that's going on, or they're going to, you know, get rid of addiction or try, you know, or rewire their brains. Why do they drink? Why did they do they do this or do that? And I think there are things like that in your life that you can be revealing even on social media to strangers, because the knock-on effect would be absolutely fantastic. And yesterday on Twitter, I talked about there's certain people who really helped me during this time, and they know who they are. A lot of people that got me through, particularly my dad's grieving, and afterwards when I sort of descended into drinking and just kind of lost the run of myself a little bit. There was people on Twitter that I'd never met in my life. Like the two of us interacted on Twitter the first time, had never had met. And there was two or three lovely people that they messaged, and I might put up a post about my dad being a month gone or something like that. And next thing you know, they'd drop you a message and they'd say, look, I went through the same thing 3 years ago, 5 years ago. This is what you need to look out for or something. Are you okay? And because they were just strangers, no, I'm not. And they have helped, and what they have, the relationship that I've built with these people, and what they have done for me. So yeah, there's like, why not put something online? Because, you could affect change, and people know it anyway. Do you know what I mean? If people who are close to you know that you're grieving, or someone passed away in your life, or the alcohol one was different, but that's sort of something that has to be out there, because we have a huge problem in Ireland about drinking, alcohol consumption, people drinking a bottle of wine a night, not telling anyone and saying they're not an alcoholic, but they're just slowly damaging themselves. And one day they're not going, they might be unlucky enough that they don't get a second chance. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I think, no, as I say, it's not for me, but it is something that I can see, I can see working, and I've had other people on the podcast talking about the reason why they do and what they do online, and exactly for that very reason is the positive effect of social media. You just mentioned something there about
there is a negative effect though.
It's very
important, not like if you're going to be personal on social media, okay, don't tell people what you had for dinner.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Don't like. You find very, I don't share, I share the big things that are important, but like there's a lot of information that nobody knows about me. I've worked with people for years and they didn't even know I was a twin or different things like this. Do you know what I mean? And especially if you're working as an actor or a writer or a director or anything like that, you need to have a bit of a blank canvas. I think it's okay to those big building blocks. But it drives me mental when someone is tweeting or putting up on Facebook like a narration of their lives, sure. Should I go for a takeaway or what? And you're like, no, just, you should delete your Facebook is what you should do, and deactivate it and go outside for a while. Do you know? So there's a fine line between,
sure.
And Twitter is okay because it's very political. Mm. And we saw that with the last general election, and it got a little bit too political, but there's a reason for that, and it's fine. But as regards, definitely on Facebook and Instagram, it's like, less is more, dude, much better. Sorry.
Look, first of all, well done on being 100 days sober, because I'm sure it was an easy decision to start with anyway. And I don't know how easy it has been, but you look fine. You look nice and relaxed and
Lighting.
But one quick question about that, because I had a guest last year, Brian Penny. He was 15 years on heroin, and he's now just written a book. It's transformed his life and everything. But the one thing he said stuck with me at the time. He said when he was a function addict, but he said it was fine at work because people thought he was drinking. That's how he put, so basically it was accepted. Okay, he's a drinker, so be it. Now, that was 6 years ago at this stage when he came off heroin and all that. But what's it like now, aside from your circle of friends, obviously know you and look after you, but is it easier to be a non-drinker? Is it easier now to be a non-drinker? Like, we'd go out, you and I go out for a beer, you'll have a non-alcoholic, it makes no difference to me. But
Yeah.
What's it like in general? Is it easier to not drinking as opposed to, there was always the pressure, come on, let's have another pint, let's have,
There is. I spoke before that I knew alcohol was a problem in my life, okay? But I could manage it. And I remember before I was close to losing control of it, and I just said to myself, do you know what? I'm not going to allow that happen. And I refocused, and I was a couple of months. I went to a film festival, and I essentially I broke there because of the pressure. Everyone was coming up, will you have a point? Will you have a point? Will you have a point? Which is fucking, it's hilarious, because a creative, you know, avenue like a film festival, you'd think people would be a little bit more open to the idea that someone might have addiction issues or problems or something like that. And also sometimes it's the stress of those bloody things, because you have to talk to 1,000 people, and there's a lot of repetition. And if you're fortunate, you're lucky enough, and you've got a movie that's doing well, you might have to go up and speak in front of a lot of people. And I remember once I broke out that way. This time I'm lucky, because I don't know why I'm laughing. I got so sick after I gave up that I, even now today, I have zero, like, I have no will to drink whatsoever. I don't miss having a pint or alcohol or anything like that. And I'm very lucky, because I think I might have drank myself out to an element. And afterwards, after the initial detox and withdrawals, I had about a week and a half of just feeling great. And then, boom, just off a cliff. The body just, I ended up getting treated for chronic fatigue, because the body just kept going in the months previous to Dad getting sick. And then drinking, because your life just kind of spiraled out of control. And the last parent especially, because, you know, your family, your childhood, you're remembering so many things, and you're kind of, your inner monologue just gets a little bit manic. And the body just held on for just like so long that once I took away alcohol, it just stopped. And I just went into like rest mode, and I was in bed for a week at one stage. I got very scared, actually, because I was getting like, I was incredibly sick. I dropped weight very quickly, because even when I was eating, I was getting sick. Essentially, just like the insides, my bloody stomach, everything. I just got incredibly ill, and had to go to the doctor, get all the works done, and go and get X-rays, and essentially I was just exhausted. And it was so bad, even the recovery. I remember the first day I got driven into Phoenix Park, and I couldn't, about 10 minutes, and I was done. I couldn't walk. Like I was just my body had just been exhausted. And I slowly built that up, and ate well, and just got into a good routine again. But it's amazing your body, how far you can push yourself beyond the point of where you should even be resting. That was like 6 months ago, and you're just pushed on to an extreme limit. But then drinking so heavily for so long, and specifically the last 3 months was nearly, well, it was every single day to an excess that your body just says no. So nowadays, going for a pint has zero, because it's just, I got so sick that the recovery was hard, that it's not an issue. And just before COVID pretty much stopped everyone in this country doing anything, I went to a play to support a friend, and we went into a pub. It was great. And I only had sparkling water or something like that. And I had zero. Before any time I'd packed in drink, it's there, you know, you're like going, God, I'd love a pint or something. And this is the first time I'd ever just gone just zero. I think I damaged myself so badly that it just, I know it's not worth it anymore. And I also know I have an addictive personality, in the sense that, like, not an addictive personality, but like I wouldn't stop. You know what I mean? And I'd use it to numb myself, and it's just, it's not a good thing. if you had taken the grieving head on after, let's say my dad passed away, and you went to counseling or something like that, it would have been fantastic. But the idea that just so much pressure, and so much of it as well, because he was sick for 2 years, and once again, family can be really incredibly tough and hard and fight with each other and cause unnecessary pressure to, we'll say, outside the family. And there was just such a build-up of problems that after he died, instead of actually going to deal with it, you just say, look, I'll do it next week. Yeah. Do it the week after. And then 3 months later, you're walking like Robert De Niro in The Irishman, because your body has just given up because you've drank so much, and you realize there's a problem here, you know, there's a problem. And you're either going to have a bloody massive heart attack one day, or you're going to tackle your issue. Why was I drinking? Grieving. And, you know, your inability to deal with kind of like your childhood being over, in a sense, when the last parent goes. But that's not like, you know, you can look at it in a depressing way, or you can say, well, you know, now is time to build on to that, you know, the next chapter. And you're probably not going to start grieving for quite a long time, because you're not going to want to take that on. You're not going to want to take the horn by the bulls, open yourself up, and just be floored by everything and have to mentally deal with everything, because you've just gone through a battle. It's like asking someone who just came back from a war to just like have a change of clothes and then just go back out to another one again, kind of thing. You know, it's when someone dies, especially when it's like cancer or long-term treatment, bloody stressful. And a lot of people get addictions, and they fall into that. And it's the same if it's not even about grieving, if it's other parts of your life instead of dealing with something. So I'm lucky right now that my brain has been rewired, but that's going to take maintenance, you know? And if you do end up drinking down the line, you have to be drinking. You can't be doing it to numb yourself or to self-harm. You have to be doing it to be enjoying yourself, having a nice glass of wine on a patio after a nice dinner with friends or something like that. But to be able to stop at a glass or two, not two bottles and two cans or something like that, and drink to the point where you need it to get to sleep, you know? So if someone can do that, great. I probably can't. I know that. And I think it's game over as regards drinking, but I'm pretty lucky in the sense that I found that out, and I've got good people that kind of helped me through that, you know?
Brilliant. Okay. Well, thanks a million for sharing all that with me. And just we're just going to leave it with the last song. What's the last song, Nimish?
The song is called Meetings of the Waters. Cillian Murphy was in the music video for it. It's kind of like Leonard Cohen. It's not like, I know everyone I've said before, there's either been a huge visual kind of impact to it, or there's been the rising, like a movie or something. But this guy is very like Leonard Cohen, where it's just, it's like a poem. It's just very, very interesting. The first time I heard it, and it was once again, I was just trying to discover more new music. Fionn Regan. I don't know, there's just something about his writing and the tone of his voice that I could take a walk into town and I could actually listen to his album, and I wouldn't feel depressed afterwards, or feel angry or overly happy, or you know, it's not... and I can't do that with a lot of music. It tends to just be a bit of classical music or a bit of... bit of swing music, actually. Just something nice and easy, like what you'd study to, or what you'd work to, you know. And I liked Fionn Regan for that. So he's definitely worth a mention.
Okay. Well, Emma Kelly, that was wonderful. It was a fantastic conversation. And listen, stay safe, stay well, and we will see you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, man.
Thanks, Emilia. Emma.
Ferns, they will bend in the moon, it will send, slide down your collar, your bones, they will mend, I know they will. Ooh. stormlight will rise up again across the wave. The meanings of the waters that I thought just below the ribs to the higher. From the roots of love.